This is a reading of a cycle of lectures by Rudolf Steiner entitled Becoming, the Archangel Michael's Companions, Rudolf Steiner's Challenge to the Younger Generation. This is lecture 4, given in Stuttgart on October 6th, 1922. Today I shall begin with an assessment of ethics up to the end of the 19th century. I do not wish to prove that philosophical expositions can give rise to an impulse for the renewal of the moral life of human beings, but rather to show that forces that work from other sources to determine the moral life are symptomatically expressed in the philosophical expositions of ethics. We must give up the view that systems of philosophy that start from the intellect can point the way directly. Yet the whole impulse of the age expresses itself in what the philosophers say. No one will declare that our reaction to the temperature of a room is influenced by the thermometer. What the thermometer registers is dependent upon the temperature of the room. In the same way, we can gauge from what philosophers say about morality the condition of morals in general. You see, I treat philosophical expositions of ethics in rather a different way, merely as a kind of thermometer for registering conditions. Just as we know the temperature of a room by reading the thermometer, so we can find out a great deal about the undercurrents of the life of humanity in a particular region or period by knowing what the philosophers express in their presentations. Consider the following only from this point of view, as I read you a passage that was printed in 1893 in the periodical Deutsche Literatur Zeitung, German literary newspaper, that deals with Spencer's title Principle of Ethics. The reviewer says, quote, "It contains, as I think, the most complete argument, supported by a crushing weight of material, that there is absolutely no such thing as one universal morality for all of humanity, nor are there any unchangeable moral laws. There exists only one norm that underlies all judgments of human characteristics and actions, namely the practical fitness or unfitness of a character or action for the given state of the society in which the judgment is made. On this account, the same things will be very differently judged according to the different cultural conditions in which they occur. The view of the present writer is that this masterpiece, Spencer's Principle of Ethics, must, from a scientific point of view at least, silence the recent attempts to base ethical judgments upon intuition, inborn feelings, or the most evident of axioms, and the like." Close quote. I read this passage to you because it is characteristic of the attitude of most of the civilized world at the end of the 19th century. It has developed to the point that it could be expressed in philosophical terms. Let us be clear about what is said here. The attempt is made in this very important work, Spencer's Principles of Ethics, to prove, as the reviewer rightly says, that the, quote, crushing weight of material, close quote, that it is impossible to draw forth from the human soul moral intuitions, moral axioms, that we must stop talking about moral intuitions. We can only say with certainty that people act according to their natural endowments. These actions are judged by the social surroundings. People are forced to bring their actions into line with the judgment of this social environment. From this, there arises conventional moral judgments, which are modified as human society changes from age to age. And a reviewer at the beginning of the 1890s said that it is at last possible to silence, so far as science is concerned, all attempts to speak of ethics and moral views that say moral intuitions arise out of the soul. I have chosen this example because it characterizes what faced one when one thought about ethics and moral impulses at that time. Into this mood of the age, my dear friends, I sent my title Intuitive Thinking as a Spiritual Path, Reader's Aside, also called The Philosophy of Freedom, or The Philosophy of Spiritual Activity, end of aside, which culminates in the view, with the end of the 19th century, the time has come when it is eminently necessary that human beings contemplate how they will be able to find moral impulses more and more by going back to the being of the human soul itself. Even for the moral impulses of everyday life, they must resort more and more to moral intuitions found in the soul. All other impulses will become gradually less decisive. This was the situation I faced. I was obliged to say that the future of human ethics depends upon the power of moral intuition becoming stronger with every passing day. Advances in moral education can only be made when we strengthen the force of moral intuition within the soul. When individuals become more and more aware of the moral intuitions which arise in their souls. Over against this stood the judgment, a merely general one, for only that which is general is expressed here, that it is proven with overwhelming evidence that all moral intuitions must be silenced. It was therefore necessary for me to attempt to write a book that would represent, in an energetic way, the very point of view that with equal vigor science declared should be forever silenced. I have given this example because it shows clearly the immensely significant turning point in the whole spiritual evolution of the West at the end of the 19th century. All of my presentations have pointed out that those who have been growing up since the end of the 19th century are faced with a totally new soul life situation from that of previous centuries. I already said with regard to the spiritual that at the end of the 19th century, human beings stood as soul beings face to face with the nothingness. It was necessary to emphasize, in relation to ethics, how that which comes from the spiritual depths and which is deemed to be most necessary for the future, moral intuitions, contrasts with that which comes from the past, the nothing that is done with its development. This turning point of the 19th century revealed itself in German culture in a most tragic way. We need only mention the name of Friedrich Nietzsche. For those who lived through the transition from the 19th to the 20th century consciously, Nietzsche represents an experience of real tragedy. Nietzsche was a personality who through the successive periods of his life poignantly experienced that he was faced with the nothingness, that nothingness which he had at first assumed to be, in quotes, something. It will perhaps not be superfluous for what you are to take into your souls during the next few days to say a few words about Nietzsche. In a certain respect, Nietzsche was the very human being who, through his tragic destiny, clearly pointed to what in the spiritual evolution of humankind at the end of the 19th century was in its twilight, making a new dawn necessary for the century just beginning. Nietzsche started from a mature scientific viewpoint. This he first met in philology in the middle of the 19th century. With a mind of extraordinary inner flexibility, Nietzsche assimilated the philological viewpoint of the middle of the 19th century, and with it he absorbed the whole spirit of Greek culture. Nietzsche was not a personality to shut himself off from the general culture. The very reverse of a theoretical scholar, he accepted naturally what he found in the middle of the 19th century, namely Schopenhauer's philosophical pessimism. This made a profound impression upon him, because he sensed more deeply than Schopenhauer the decline of the spiritual life, in the midst of which he was living. The only light that pointed toward the future for Nietzsche was in Richard Wagner's music. Wagner, as regards his worldview, was a follower of Schopenhauer at the time he made Nietzsche's acquaintance. Thus, towards the beginning of the last third of the 19th century, Nietzsche developed a view that was no theory, but the very substance of life to him, namely, that already in Greek culture the age had dawned in which the full human essence was being crushed by intellectualism. Nietzsche was not correct in regard to the complete development of intellectualism, for For in the form in which Nietzsche experienced intellectualism as an all-destroying spirit, it had, as I said yesterday, only since the 15th century come upon the scene. What Nietzsche experienced was the intellectualism of the immediate present. He dated it back to the later age of Greek culture, and held that the influence working so destructively upon what was livingly spiritual began with Socrates. And so Nietzsche became anti-Socratic in his philosophy. With the advent of Socrates in the spiritual life of Greece, he saw intellectualism and rationality driving away an old spirituality. Not many have grasped with such innate power the contrast between the character of Greek culture as it appears in the writings of Aeschylus or of Sophocles, in the early sculpture, and in the mighty philosophies of men like Heraclitus, Anaxagoras, and others, this life of soul, still full of spiritual impulses, and that other life of soul, which gradually began to paralyze the true spirituality. According to Nietzsche, this began with Socrates, who confronted all-world questions with intellectual questions, and who established his art of definition with regard to everything. Nietzsche felt that when that began, humanity no longer looked at the immediate and living spirit in the natural way. Provided this idea is not carried too far, and thus made intellectual itself, it shows that Nietzsche sensed something of great significance. You see, real experience of the spiritual, wherever we meet it, always becomes individual. Definition, however, inevitably becomes generalization. In going through life and meeting individuals, we must always have an open heart, an open mind for the individual. Towards each single individual, we should be able to unfold a completely new human feeling for every individual we meet. We do justice to a human being only when we see in the person an entirely new personality. For this reason, every individual has the right to expect of us that we should develop a new feeling for that person as a human being. If we come with a general idea in our heads, saying that a human being should be like this or like that, we are being unjust to the individual. With every definition of a human being, we really put up a screen to make the human being invisible. Nietzsche felt this in regard to the spiritual life, hence his opposition to Socratic teaching. And so during the 60s and early 70s of the 19th century, the idea grew in his soul that true living Greek culture has a kind of pessimism at the root of its feeling about the world. He thought the Greeks were convinced that immediate life in its elementary form cannot give people satisfaction, a complete feeling of human dignity. Therefore the Greeks took refuge in what art was to them. And to the Greeks the art they cultivated, in the time of their prime, was the great comforter, helping to overcome what was lacking in material existence. Thus for Nietzsche, Greek art could be understood only out of the Greeks' tragic feeling about life. And he thought that this mission of art would again be revived by Wagner and his artistic impulse. The 1870s approached, and Nietzsche felt that this could not be, because in his time he failed to find the impulse that the Greeks had set up as the great consoler for the material life around them. And so he reflected, what was it that I wanted to find in Wagner's art as a renewal of Greek art? It was ideals. But it dawned upon him, as he let these ideals work upon his soul, that they were similar to those of his own epoch. In the mid-1870s, there came a terribly tragic moment in Nietzsche's life, the moment when he felt his ideals belonged to his own times. He was forced to admit, my ideals are no different from what this present age calls its ideals. After all, I am drawing from the same forces from which my own age draws its ideals. This was a moment of great pain for Nietzsche, for he had experienced the idealistic tendencies manifest in his day. He had experienced, for example, David Friedrich Strauss, revered by the whole age as a great man, but whom he had unmasked as a Philistine. and he realized that his own ideals, stimulated by his absorption in Wagner and in Greek art, strongly resembled those of his time. But these ideals seemed to him impotent and unable to grasp the spiritual. So he said to himself, "If I am true to myself, I cannot have any ideals in common with my time." This was a tragic discovery for him, even if not expressed in these words. Any of you who have steeped yourselves in what Nietzsche lived through during the years of which I am speaking knows that there came for Nietzsche the tragic moment when, in his own way, he said that when some people today speak of ideals, and these coincide with what others call their ideals, then they are moving in the realm of empty phrases that are no longer the living body, but the dead corpse of the spirit. This brought Nietzsche to the conviction, "I must resolutely put aside the ideals I have evolved hitherto." Putting aside all his ideals began in the middle of the 70s. He published his title Human, All Too Human, title The Dawn of Day, and title The Joyful Wisdom, works in which he pays some homage to Voltaire, but which also contain a certain view of human morals. An external inducement to forsake his former idealism and steer toward the views of his second period came from his acquaintance with the works of Paul Ray. Paul Ray treated moral nature and its development from a purely scientific point of view, entirely in line with the natural science of the day. Paul Ray gave the very interesting little book titled On the Genealogy of Moral Perceptions, and also a book titled The Genesis of Conscience. This book, which everyone should read who wants to know about the nature of thought in the last third of the 19th century, had a very deep influence on Nietzsche. What is the spirit of this book? Again, I am describing it not because I think that philosophy has a direct influence upon life. I do so because I want to point to a gauge for culture by which we can read the state of the ethical impulses, views, and thinking of the time. According to Paul Ray's view, human beings originally had no more than what, in his opinion, a child has, namely a life of instinct, impulses of unconscious instinctive activity. Individual human beings, when they become active, come up against others. Certain of these activities, unfolded toward the outer world, happen to suit other human beings to their benefit. Other activities may be harmful. From this there arises the judgment that what proceeds from the instinctive activities of the human being as beneficial is gradually seen to be, in quotes, good. What proves harmful to others is branded as, in quotes, evil. Life becomes more complicated all the time. People forget how they put labels on things. They speak of good and evil and have forgotten that in the beginning the good was simply what was beneficial and the evil was felt to be harmful. So, finally, what has arisen has become instinct, has recast itself as instinct. It is just as if someone struck out blindly with an arm. If the result is a caress, then this is called good. If it is a box on the ears, then it is evil. And so judgments pile up. The sum of such judgments becomes instinct. Just as little as we know how to raise our hand, just so little do we know how a voice comes out of the soul and utters this or that moral judgment. This voice we then call conscience. This voice of conscience is merely what has arisen out of instinctive judgments about the beneficial and the harmful. It has become instinct. Because its origin has been forgotten, it sounds from within as the voice of conscience. Nietzsche realized fully that not everyone would agree with Paul Ray, but he was also quite clear that when views on natural science were such as they were in his day, it is impossible to think about ethics otherwise than in the way Paul Ray did. Nietzsche was thoroughly honest. He deduced the ultimate consequences as Paul Ray had done. Nietzsche bore the philosopher no grudge for having written such things. This had not much more significance for Nietzsche than what was circumscribed by the four walls of the room in which Paul Rey did his writing, just as a thermometer indicates nothing more than the temperature of the immediate environment. However, it shows something that exists in general, and Nietzsche sensed this. He felt the ethical sediment of the times in this book. And with this he agreed. For him there was nothing more important than to put aside the old empty phrase, and to say that when people talk about nebulous ideals, they make nothing clear. In fact, everything is instinct. Nietzsche often said to himself that when people are enthusiastic about certain ideals and want to enthuse others for those ideals, it is in the end because they are so constituted that when they are thinking of these ideals, they can work up the juices in their stomachs in the best way for the digestion of their food. I am putting this rather radically, but it is exactly what Nietzsche felt in the 70s and 80s of the 19th century. He said to himself, "People talk about all sorts of spiritual things and call them ideals, but in reality it amounts to no more than that people, each according to their own constitution, digest and carry out bodily functions in the best way when they feel thusly about the so-called ideal. What is known as human must be divested of the empty phrase, for in truth the human is all too human." With a magnificent devotion to honesty, Nietzsche declared war on all idealism. I know that this aspect of Nietzsche has not always been emphasized. A great deal that has been said about him is pure snobbery, without anything earnest in it. So Nietzsche found himself facing the nothingness at the end of the first period of his spiritual development, and consciously facing the nothingness in a second period that began with human all too human and ended with the joyful wisdom. Finally, only one mood remained, for it is impossible to reach a real spiritual content when all ideals are traced back to bodily functions. One example will show what Nietzsche's view became. He said to himself, "There are people who work toward asceticism, that is to say, toward abstention from physical enjoyment. Why do they do this? They do it because they have exceedingly bad digestion and feel most comfortable when they abstain from physical enjoyment. That is why they regard asceticism as the highest aim worth striving for. But unconsciously they are seeking what makes them most comfortable. They wish to feel the greatest enjoyment in the absence of enjoyment. That absence of enjoyment is their greatest enjoyment, shows us how they are constituted." Let me read that last sentence again. "That absence of enjoyment is their greatest enjoyment, shows us how they are constituted." In Nietzsche, who was thoroughly honest, this mood intensified to moments when he gave vent to words like these, my attempt at the German, "Ich wohne in meinem eigenen Haus, hab niemand etwas nachgemacht, und lache jeden Meister aus, der sich nicht selber ausgelacht." Translation, "I dwell within my own house and have imitated no one, and laugh at every master who has not laughed at himself." In its poetic anticipation, this verse is a magnificent description of the mood that came to its climax about the turn of the 19th century. Yet it was already there, earlier in a form that made itself felt in the depths of the soul life. Nietzsche found his way out of this second period of facing the nothingness by creating what is implicit in two ideas to which he gave poetic expression. The one was the idea of the superhuman, because for him there was ultimately nothing left but to call upon something that must be born out of the human being, but was not yet there. Secondly, after his grandiose experience of facing nothingness, there arose the idea of the eternal recurrence of the same, which came to him out of the idea of evolution. In his scientific period, he had become familiar with the idea of evolution, but as he steeped himself in what came from these thoughts about evolution, he discovered nothing that would bring evolution forward. These only gave him the idea of eternal recurrence of the same. This was his last period, which need not be described any further, although from the point of view of psychology a very great deal might be learned from it. I do not wish to do a character study, but only to indicate how Nietzsche, who was forced through illness to lay down his pen at the end of the 1880s, had experienced in advance the mood that dominated deeper souls at the turn of the 19th into the 20th century. During the last third of the 19th century, Nietzsche tried to express a mood drawn from his store of ideas, from Greek philosophy and art, from art as found in Wagner, from the philosophy of Schopenhauer, and so on. But time and again, Nietzsche himself abandoned his own views. One of his last works is called The Twilight of the Idols, or How to Philosophize with a Hammer. He felt himself as a destroyer of the old ideas. It was really very remarkable, for the old ideas had already been destroyed by the spirit of cultural evolution. During Nietzsche's youth, the store of ideas was already destroyed. Since the 14th and 15th centuries, ideas continued through tradition, but came to an end in the last third of the 19th century. The old spirit was already in ruins. It was only in the empty phrase, the cliché, that these ideas lived on. Those who thought in accordance with spiritual reality in Nietzsche's day would not have felt that they had to smash the ideals with a hammer, but that they had already been smashed simply in the necessary and proper course of evolution of the human race. Humanity would not have achieved freedom if this had not happened. But Nietzsche, who found these ideals still blossoming in the empty phrase, was under the illusion that he himself was doing what had already long been done. What had been the inner fuel of the spiritual life in the former age, the fuel whereby the spirit in humanity could be kindled and, once kindled, illuminate both nature and his own life, this had passed away. In the specific realm of the moral, this is expressed by people saying, there can be no moral intuitions any longer. As I mentioned yesterday, theoretical refutations of materialism as world conception are sheer nonsense, for materialism has its justification in this age. Thoughts that our age has to recognize as right are products of the brain. Therefore, a refutation of materialism is, in itself, an empty phrase. And no one who is honest can see the good of refuting materialism theoretically, for nothing is to be gained by it. Human beings have come to the stage of evolution where they no longer have an inner living spirit, but only a reflection of the spirit entirely dependent upon the physical brain. Here materialism is fully justified as a theoretical world conception. The point is not that people have a false world conception, or whether they refute it, but that they have gradually come to an inner attitude of life and soul that is lacking in spirit. This rings tragically like a cry through Nietzsche's philosophy. This is the situation of the spiritual life, in which souls with natural feeling among the young of the 20th century find themselves. You will not come to any clear view, to any tangible experience of what is brewing indistinctly, subconsciously in your souls, and what you call the experiences of youth, unless you look into this shift that has taken place necessarily in the spiritual life of the present period of evolution. If you try to characterize what you experience on other bases, you will feel, after a time, that you can always brush it aside. You will not hit upon a truth, but only upon clichés. For unless the human being today honestly admits, I must grasp the living, the active spirit, the spirit that no longer has its reality, but only its corpse in intellectualism. Unless I come to this, there is no rescue from the confusion of the age. As long as one believes that one can find spirit in intellectualism, which is merely the form of the spirit, in the same way as the human corpse is the form of the human being, human beings will not find themselves. To find ourselves is only possible if we will honestly confess. Intellectualism has the same relationship to the living essence of the spirit as a dead corpse to the person who has died. The form is still there, but the life of the spirit has gone out of intellectualism. Just as the human corpse can be treated with preparations that preserve its form, as indeed Egyptian mummies show, so too can the corpse of the spirit be preserved by padding it out with the results of experiment and observation. But thereby people get nothing of what is livingly spiritual. They get nothing that they can unite naturally with the living impulses of the soul. They get nothing but a dead thing. A dead thing that can wonderfully reflect what is dead in the world, just as one can still marvel at the human form in the mummy. However, in intellectualism, we cannot get what is truly spiritual any more than a real human being can be made out of a mummy. As long as importance is attached to preserving what the union of observation and intellect is intended to preserve, one can only say, the achievements of the modern age are great. The moment human beings have to unite in the depths of their soul with what their spirit inwardly holds up before them, there can be no link between intellectualism and the soul. Then the only thing is for them to say, we are thirsting for something, and nothing we find out of intellectuality gives us water to quench our thirst. This is what lives in the feelings of young people today, although, naturally, it is not so clear when expressed in words. Young people today say many things, annoying things when one gets to the bottom of what is said, but one soon overcomes it. The annoyance is due to the fact that bombastic words are used that express anything rather than what the speaker really feels. The empty phrase overreaches itself. And what appears as the character of the youth movement is, for one who lives in the spirit, like a continuous bursting of bubbles. It is really intellectualism overreaching itself. I do not want to hurt any of you personally, but if it does hurt, I cannot help it. I would be sorry, but I would still think it extraordinarily right to say it. I cannot say only pleasant things. I must sometimes say things that will not please everyone. I must say what I know to be true. So in order to characterize what is rightly there in the souls of young people today, we need something more than a revival of old concepts overreaching themselves in empty phrases. We need an intensively developed feeling for the truth. We need truth at the bottom of our souls. Truth is the alpha and the omega of what we need today. And when your chairman said yesterday that we have gotten to a point where we do not want to utter the word spirit any longer, that is in itself a confession of the truth. It would be much more prudent if our age, which has lost the spirit, would succeed in not talking about the spirit, because then human beings would again begin to thirst for the spirit. Instead of this, one calls everything possible spirit and spiritual. What we need is truth. And if any young people today acknowledge the condition of their own souls, they can only say, this age has taken all spirit out of my soul. But my soul thirsts for the spirit, thirsts for something new, thirsts for a new conquest of the spirit. As long as this is not felt in all honesty and truth, the youth movement cannot come into its own. Let me add the following to what I have said in characterization of what we must seek. In the deepest, innermost being of the soul, we must seek for light. Above all else, we must acquire the most profound feeling for honesty and truth. If we build upon honesty and truth, then we shall progress, and humanity must indeed progress. Then we shall again be allowed to speak of the spirit, which is most like our human nature. The soul is most of all like the spirit. Therefore it can find the spirit if only it so wills. In our time the soul must strive beyond empty phrase, convention, and routine, beyond the empty phrase to a grasp of truth, beyond convention to a direct, elementary, warm-hearted relation between one human being and another, beyond routine to the state in which the spirit lives in every single action, so that we no longer act automatically, but that the spirit lives in the most ordinary everyday actions. We must come to spirituality in action, to the immediate experience of human beings in their relations to one another, and to an honest, upright experience of truth. the end of Lecture 4.